Welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reismanel, and I'm your host. On today's program, are we looking at an online music world without digital rights management and reflecting back on 5 years of Media Geek? And of course, I'll catch up with what's going on in our media environment with some Media Geek news. Do stay tuned. Well, now it's April, but March is roughly the anniversary of Media Geek. Media Geek had kind of what we might call a soft start, because here at the home station, WEFT in Champaign, shows often get a chance to audition on the air before they are granted a time slot, and it was during February and March of 2002 that Media Geek auditioned for its full-time slot, which is live here in Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM, 5:30s on Friday, then heard afterwards on different community stations around the country, and of course online as a podcast beginning midnight Sunday nights. So April is about when it was hitting full steam as a regular program. It so that this being 2007 signals 5 years on the air for this particular program. And it only really kind of hit me this week that I'd been doing this for 5 years. You know, it's cliche to say it goes by fast, but it sure as heck has. In many ways, the show is very similar to when it started. In many ways, it's different. And a little later in the show, I want to talk a bit, you know, reflecting back on some of the changes that we've seen, not just to the show, but to our communications landscape. But something that I've been doing since the very start is bringing some headline news to most of the programs in nearly every episode. And the reason I do this is because I do think there's so many stories about what goes on in the media. There's legislation. There are deals that happen between different companies. There's antitrust, there's things at the FCC, and there's other sort of more grassroots or underground sorts of bits of news that you might not otherwise hear of. And the problem is that by and large, these stories are covered like business stories, almost across the board in newspapers and what little that they're covered on television and in radio. And really the only place you see them covered with regularity is on internet sites. But of course, again, with the general interest sites like a CNN.com, a NewYorkTimes.com, and on, they're still covered in the same fashion as business stories, as if anything that goes on regarding the media, regarding telecommunications, is only about making money or losing money, as the case may be. And really, it's about our democracy. That is the reason why there is a First Amendment in the United States and why the press has been called the Fourth Estate and why we continue to work so hard to preserve there being free press, and not just a free press of the type of the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times, but of the average individual and folks from every walk of life, from every social group, from every economic group, being able to communicate freely their stories. You know, it's an old cliche that freedom of the press belongs to everyone who owns one. And part of Media Geek is trying to see how everyone can own some version of the press. And all of these things, all these little arcane decisions that get made in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere really can impact that. That's why I bring you these news. And of course, our ability to receive information is as important as our ability to communicate it. So let's take a look a bit at what's going on this week. The fight over the future of cable television and services like public access and government channels isn't close to over yet. Last December, the FCC voted to relax the authority of local municipalities over new entrants in the cable TV markets, namely telephone companies like AT&T and Verizon. Unlike traditional cable operators like Comcast or Insight, The telcos will not be required to negotiate a contract with each local municipality for the right to offer cable TV services using the public right-of-way. This party line vote angered city governments, public access television groups, and traditional cable companies, who all believe the telcos are getting an unfair advantage and will use it to undercut the rights municipalities and consumers have had for more than 20 years. On Tuesday, April 3rd, local authorities brought the issue to court, filing suit in federal appeals courts nationwide to overturn the FCC's new rules. However, according to Republican FCC Commissioner Robert McDowell, he isn't going to let that challenge stop his efforts to apply the same relaxation to the rules that oversee traditional cable operators. Yet one group participating in the court challenge says that the FCC didn't have the authority to enact the first set of rules relaxation to begin with. The groups filing suit against the FCC include the National Association of Telecommunications Officials and Advisors, the National Association of Counties, and the National League of Cities. Challengers were filed in Atlanta, Cincinnati, Denver, Philadelphia, New York, and Richmond, Virginia, claiming the FCC has abused its authority and charging that the recent FCC order will, quote, severely restrict the ability of local governments to protect their citizens' rights of way, community channels, and public safety networks, end quote. And staying with the topic of television, on February 17th, 2009, analog TVs will be officially obsolete. That's because it's the date broadcasters will turn off their analog signals and go all digital, and it's mandated by law. Consumers who can't or don't want to upgrade to a digital set are supposed to be able to obtain a coupon from the federal government that will allow them to buy a digital converter box at a reduced price. But according to recent testimony in front of the Telecommunications Internet Subcommittee of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, obtaining one of those boxes might not be so easy. A senior vice president for the major electronics retailer Best Buy told congresspeople that he's not sure the chain will carry the converters in all of its stores. On top of that, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the converter coupon program will cost $3.6 billion, more than twice the $1.5 billion that Congress allocated last year. While some members of Congress and public interest groups are worried about millions of American households being left out in the cold when analog TV signals go dark, other congresspeople, and some of the same ones, and public safety advocates are concerned that the analog TV turnoff will get delayed further. And they're concerned because a chunk of the electromagnetic spectrum that will be vacated is slated to be used for interoperable public safety communications in order to avoid the communications problems between agencies that occurred on September 11th. And the FCC plans to auction off most of the rest of the spectrum that will be vacated when analog TV goes dark. But a coalition of public interest and consumer groups say the FCC should set aside some of it to create a true high-speed wireless internet service. In a filing with the FCC, the Save Our Spectrum Coalition urged the commission to create the service in the 700 megahertz band, which is currently UHF television, in such a way that consumers will be, quote, free to use any equipment, content, application, or service on a non-discriminatory basis without interference from the network provider, end quote. Importantly, such a service would provide strong protections for net neutrality, allowing consumers to use their internet service in any legal fashion they like. It would be a bit sort of like creating a big wireless phone service, but like the modern phone service, you could call anyone, connect any device, and communicate however you like without any interference or anyone getting in your way. That's what they'd like to see. The groups in the Save the Spectrum Coalition include Free Press, Consumers Union, and Public Knowledge. And speaking of public knowledge, they are a group that works in Washington on issues of public interest, specifically on things like intellectual property, things like a lot of things in the communication sphere, like media ownership. And they're taking somewhat, shall we say, unusual position on the proposed merger between XM and Sirius Satellite Radio, something I've talked about in the last few weeks here and Media Geek. And I want to highlight it because so much of the time it seems like they're, when we talk about public interest and we talk about these various media reform groups, it seems like there's very well delineated sides when it comes to, say, broadcast ownership. There's a side that says, don't loosen the rules. We don't want more clear channels. And there's a side, usually the owner, saying we need more consolidation. Clear Channel needs to get bigger if it's going to survive. And public knowledge is typically on the, you know, as a public interest working group, on the side of, say, not having a bigger Clear Channel. But on the issue of XM and Sirius, they're taking the position that they're not necessarily sure the proposed merger should be opposed. In fact, what they have suggested to Congress and the FCC is that if there is such a merger, instead it would be better and in the public interest to propose some criteria on the merger. The conditions include that the new company would make available pricing choices and tiered programming. So currently with XM and Sirius, I believe it's an all or nothing deal, more or less, one monthly rate, and you get the whole slate. And so what public knowledge is suggesting is that perhaps you'd be able to subscribe to a very small amount of programming, like basic cable with television, or get a larger package. And here's an interesting one, is that they suggest that the new company, the XM Sirius merged company, would make 5% of its capacity available to non-commercial educational informational programming over which it has no editorial control. And that's the one that really kind of struck me, because that is a real potential opening for better communication or better public interest communication. If you look to DirecTV and Dish Network, the two major satellite TV providers in the United States, each of them has a slate of non-commercial educational informational channels, which they have, which was a qualification for them to get their licenses to start doing direct broadcast satellite TV. I myself actually subscribe to Dish Network, and one of the reasons I do is because they carry Free Speech TV, which is an organization that I really like, really support, out of Boulder, Colorado, which started out on the internet and then was able to secure one of these slots to bring all sorts of really great grassroots, independent, interesting public affairs programming, and it's a completely non-commercial service, and it's 24 hours a day on Dish Network, and it's not on DirecTV. And so the proposition of having, you know, 5% capacity turned over to community radio station like networks on Sirius or XM sounds kind of attractive to me. Other things PK says, PK being public knowledge, is that the company would have to agree not to raise the prices for their combined programming packages for 3 years after the merger is approved. So, you know, they are trying to really push for the public interest. And yet, you know, a counter argument would be, well, but isn't a merger is a merger is a merger, and a monopoly is a monopoly. We're taking two entrants in satellite radio and turning it into one. Can that really be in the public interest? And they say, well, yes and no. One of the arguments that public knowledge is saying is that, you know, that satellite radio truly is competing with broadcast radio in particular, and you really shouldn't see them as different, and that opposing the merger puts you into the same size as the broadcast lobby, the National Association of Broadcasters, which is very vigorously opposing the merger of Sirius and XM. And the National Association of Broadcasters, of course, is made up by such companies as Clear Channel, largest owner of radio stations in the United States. And so they're sort of cautioning their peers in the public interest group arena to not necessarily be drawn in and be on the side of the broadcasters, and that should this merger not be approved or be thwarted, that's just playing into the hands of exactly what the broadcasters want, and it may not actually be in the public interest because of the threat to this other competing service of satellite radio. I'm not sure I buy it. I'm not sure I don't, but it was some food for thought, and these things do have to be a debate, I think, even on the side of those who are fighting for the public interest and who are really taking aim at the over-commercialization, monopolization, and homogenization of our major mainstreaming corporate media. And this is Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel, and I'm your host, and we're celebrating 5 years of Media Geek here. Check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, the home of the Media Geek blog. Get the radio show at radio.mediageek.net, where you can download it in MP3 or Ogg Vorbis. You can also subscribe to the podcast, so you can get it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's radio.mediageek.net. If you have any comments about the program, send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. And you know, policy, it's kind of a messy arena, frankly, and it is definitely a sausage factory. And I cover it some weeks fairly reluctantly here on the Media Geek Show, simply because it's a realm played out with lobbyists and folks who are connected, and with legislators, and with industry representatives, and with all sorts of other groups. And it's not one that's particularly friendly to average people, even though there are groups like Public Knowledge and Free Press and Consumers Union who work very hard to try and operate on behalf of really the interests of most people, not those who own necessarily those who own lots of media company stock or themselves own lots of radio TV stations and media properties. But it can feel a little disempowering at times. It does to me, even when it feels like all that we can do is to fill out online petitions and sign our name to something. I feel like really the flip side is very much being able to make our own media, and that's why I do Media Geek here. And I have one more little thing I wanted to mention before I sort of reflect back on 5 years of Media Geek, and that is the announcement in the past week by Apple that they've reached a deal with EMI Records, a fairly large European label, that they're going to start offering tracks on iTunes that don't have copy protection, otherwise known as digital rights management. They're going to charge 30 cents more per song. They normally charge 99 cents per song in the U.S., and they're going to start charging $1.29 for these tracks. So you'll be able to get either. If you want to pay less, you'll get tracks which have the copy protection. And for $1.29, you get ones that don't have copy protection. And that's being looked at as a pretty big move on the part of Apple and CEO Steve Jobs, as well as EMI. But of course, if you read the news about the record industry, it should be very clear that they're doing very poorly at this point, with CD sales going down and online music sales not necessarily making up for the difference. And of course, one of the longstanding criticisms of DRM, of copyright protection on music, is that you're really renting music, not owning it. When you buy music from the iTunes music store, you can only use it on your iPod or your Apple computer or a computer that has iTunes. And it's hard to transport. Certainly, it's hard to share. You can burn CDs, and that's one little hole. But mostly, you're renting the music because if you put it onto a computer, it's not authorized to play your track, it won't play. And Steve Jobs said about a month ago in a very public statement put out on Apple.com, he actually isn't a fan of DRM, but that he couldn't get the music labels to sign on. At the same time, Apple is facing pressure from European regulators because of the fact that they don't license their technology to other players. So it means the iTunes Music Store only works with iPods. And Steve Jobs says he didn't, because then that would put a big hole in the system where there could be potential piracy of the iTunes tracks. And said that he'd be glad to get rid of DRM. And I guess this is he wants to see this as an instance of him putting his money where his mouth is. And people are wondering if this is going to put the challenge to Warner Music and Sony BMG and other big major labels to start offering their music without copy protection. Of course, if you look to CDs, most of them historically don't have copy protection. Of course, sales are going down, and labels will like to blame it on the fact that that people are simply trading songs online and not buying them. And a lot of other people will argue that it's because, one, they're not putting out good records so much anymore. CDs are prohibitively priced, and buying from iTunes Music Store isn't such a good deal, even though there are some other companies like eMusic.com that do offer and have offered MP3s without any sort of copy protection for a while on a subscription basis. eMusic in particular specializes in small independent labels, not major labels. As a disclaimer, I do subscribe to eMusic, and I like it because it is all about small independent labels, and I don't mind those small labels getting paid for the MP3s that I get, even though I admit that the MP3s are not as good quality to my ears as a regular CD or vinyl, for that matter. The convenience outweighs it, because I frankly do walk around with an MP3 player, and I like being able to get new music for it relatively inexpensively and very easily. And my argument personally, at least, is if you make the music accessible enough and reasonably priced enough, I'll buy it. And I have no problem doing so. So we'll see what new is coming up with the Apple deal and whether this will spark a change in the music industry or rather sort of cleave it down the middle. One note about the format is in what's called AAC, which is a it's a open format, but you do pay royalties on it. So anyone want to implement this format of AAC, which is not as universal as MP3, is paying royalties into a coalition of groups known as MPEG. I believe Apple is a member, and they do pay royalties for use of this scheme. But it does sound better than MP3s for the same size file. But it does mean that a lot of MP3 players are not yet ready to play these tracks, because up to now there hasn't been much need to. So we'll just keep our eyes on that. So take a look at this 5 years of Media Geek. I said I started out in 2002, and actually I've been doing a program on these sorts of issues going back all the way to 1996. I did it here at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, which is the home of Media Geek Radio Show. Did Sunday mornings alternating for a half an hour. Alternating weeks, and it's called Radio Free Conscience, not the best name, I'll admit, and gave me an opportunity for, in that case, 6 years to really kind of get a sense for how to do this kind of show and how to bring a lot of these ideas to their airwaves and share them with people. I did it because it's always been my passion, a bit of a geek, obviously, give it a name and a show, for media production, and also always paid attention to what was going on historically, what was going on in terms of policy and what was going on in terms of legislation and in the industry. Always been interested in it since I was a kid and spent a number of years studying it as a graduate student, which I am not any longer. I really felt that this is something important, as I said at the top of this program, for people to understand. But also, as I alluded to earlier, I think it's really important the element of people being able to make their media, to be able to produce, to be able to share. And I was seeing in my years in community radio how this medium gave so many more people so much more power to communicate and to share and to also help others communicate and share. And I was involved in the media movement starting back in 2000 with the creation of Independent Media Center here in Urbana-Champaign, and saw how bridging it then, this idea to the internet and to areas like print, held so much potential. And it was really something to talk about and to share and to, I think, promote. And it's not, to me, a David and Goliath story. And I don't think that, it's a matter that this one little internet broadcaster, one little newspaper, one little website necessarily tears down the Clear Channels of the world. So much is that I think it's important that there's millions and millions of these broadcasters and communicators and publishers out there providing not just an alternative, but an answer and almost another way of looking at the world. And frankly, when I started this program in 2002, I could not have predicted the rise of YouTube or podcasting or MySpace or, really how the generation that is now in high school and going to college has grown up with the internet and takes for granted technology like digital cameras, digital video recorders, digital audio recorders, and the ability to place all these things on the internet. Takes for granted in the same way that I'm 35, take for granted camcorders, certainly, but analog camcorders. It took for granted tape recorders and record players, TVs and radios. You wouldn't be able to see it come together. And of course, the big buzzword now in the industry is what's called user-generated content. That's YouTube, right? How can we make money on the content that people produce and want to share? And they're not making money yet, I think, if we look at it. And of course, user-generated content is not nearly, to me, the way I want to look at it. Because what I want to look at it is independent media, individual media. Right, free media out there, not just contributing it to YouTube for them to make money on, but contributing it because I think it's a value and I think other people will benefit for it or may share it, may be inspired by it, may answer it. And the big question in 2002 for me and before that in terms of being able to share media was the cost of doing so. The fact that, having your website with enough bandwidth to be able to have video and audio was still a question. And that was so powerful about the rise of indie media because it was this pooling of resource on an international basis so that this could happen. And truly, I think revolutionary at that moment to create a website where anyone could upload and anyone could share, along with other ideas like RadioForAll.net, which has stuck around and provide the same sort of thing for radio production. And so it's interesting to see now that that, I think, really brought on the things like YouTube as bandwidth became less expensive, as the programming tools became easier to use, as, you know, these things all came together to make it more commercially viable, because I think that indie media was not commercially viable in 2000, in 2002, nor did it want to be, nor does it want to be commercially viable. But it really did push that envelope. As it continues to still push envelopes in a lot of regions. But it also makes me wonder where we go from here. I'm not anti-YouTube. I am anti-MySpace personally, because it's owned by Rupert Murdoch. It's a personal thing. Or anti-Google Video, although I'm always going to be concerned about hosting my material only there, since I don't control it. And there's always the possibility it'll disappear, either because the company goes away or because someone objects to it and wants it down. But I think as we move forward, I think the initial impulse is right, that we still need to know about things like copyright law. We still need to know about what's going on in Washington. And then with the ability, how instrumental the internet has been in allowing us to distribute independent media in a way really we're never able to do before. You know, 10 years ago, you'd have had to mail cassettes or CDs around the country to get this show on a weekly basis. And now I can just upload it once and it can get on to 10 stations. That means we need to protect network neutrality, and we can see how understanding what goes on in Washington, it's not all hands off. Laissez-faire is a myth, and deregulation is a myth. It is re-regulation. And we need to understand and we need to know what's going on if we're going to make sure that our rights and our abilities to share and communicate are upheld. And I think we also need to know who's doing what. We need to see other people doing this stuff for inspiration, to go find new things to listen and watch. And to know that, you know, this isn't just for videos of people getting punched in the groin, but it's for real liberatory communication. So I'm going to keep doing this, even though week to week it's difficult, because this is a volunteer gig. And I have a full-time job, and I'm trying to do a lot of other things. And I hope you do appreciate it. I hope you enjoy it. And we'll see. Maybe we can do 5 years. Maybe 5 years from now, who knows what the medium will be.
That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.